Joining me on Impact Catalyst is Bridget Heller, the founder of the Shirley Proctor Pooler Foundation. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me, Jeff.
First, how are you? How are you holding up during this interesting time we're finding ourselves in?
So we're holding up very well. I feel like I'm personally incredibly blessed. I have all of the basics, which many of the people that we are serving in the community don't have. So I just feel incredibly blessed during this whole time.
Can you talk a little bit about the foundation so people who aren't familiar with it can get familiar?
Sure. So about 5 years ago, we started this foundation in 2015. It's named after my mom, who was a wonderful educator in the community for about 35 years or so, teaching primarily at Northeast. And what happened was that over time, she saw the deterioration of, or what she felt was a deterioration in the community school system. And it got completely or continuously worse for her, at least in her view. And so in 2010 or so, a little bit before that, perhaps, she and friends started to distribute books in the community and to actually spend their time trying to teach children, local children, to read. And she constantly was talking to us all about it from a family perspective. So when she passed in 2013, we knew right away that we wanted to continue that legacy of trying to help children to regain that literacy confidence and really close that achievement gap that had emerged between them and their national peers from a community perspective. So as we looked to do that, we began this foundation. We made it a 501c3 in 2014. We registered it. And then in 2015, we began the work of really researching to understand how to go after closing this achievement gap. In 2015, we decided that the way we would go after it would actually be through out-of-school time, trying to work alongside the district to really make sure that all of their efforts were continuing. And we decided we would focus on summer and closing the summer learning gap in specific. And so we launched a program called the Master Kids Program, which was a summer camp for about 70 kids. And it's done incredibly well over the last 4 years. We have been able to close the achievement gap in the to the extent that 80% of the children attending our summer program have not suffered any learning loss, which is a significant achievement given the fact that children similar to these on a national basis typically lose somewhere around 12 weeks of learning.
That's the summer slide.
Yeah, it's called the summer slide, exactly.
So when you think back to your mother talking about what she was disappointed in the education system that led her to, you know, to work with the books or to provide the books. Do you remember how she articulated that? What reasons she saw and where specifically those reasons manifested themselves in the education?
Yeah, so I can actually talk about her perspective and then I'd love to also share mine.
Sure.
In her view, she really reflected on the fact that there was this community of African Americans that lived very closely together and they were very close knit as she grew up. And there was this sort of history of education that had come to be within that community. And there was this value for education. And what she saw was two things. One, she saw the value of education as a concept really being eroded over time. She felt that for whatever reason, and in her view, it was really attributed somewhat to the disbursement of the community, that she felt like the value of education as a concept was really eroded, and that there was no longer this sort of community that felt education was really key to this continuing success, and particularly economic success of the community. So that was sort of one thing that she felt was at the corner of it or at the center of it. The other thing she felt was at the center of it, to be very honest, was she felt that there was a commitment of a group of educators in the past to African-American children in specific, right? That had now gone away because, again, those teachers weren't even coming together to share. But certainly you, when you go into an integrated school system, you don't have necessarily that sort of collaboration and sharing and that understanding of the cultural impact that is facing or the cultural challenges that are facing those children. And as a result, she felt like that was also contributing to the children being more disciplined, or disciplined more harshly, you know, not having the same opportunity for excellence or even the same expectations for excellence that used to be set back in those days. And so she really felt that the sort of coming together of all of that was resulting in really, really poor outcomes for the children.
So that's slightly different take on, you know, when you look at like the Failure Factory articles and things like that, that are heavy on the curriculum and administrative side. Your mom was looking at it more from a decay of the cultural or, you know, the you know, society's placing a value on that education, and people weren't adjusting to those changes the right way.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it was both, actually. I think, you know, I think that the Failure Factories article, for example, captured a lot of this excess discipline because they didn't, because some of the teachers, for example, just didn't know some of the cultural norms or some of the cultural behavioral sort of expressions of grief or anger or, you know, those kinds of different things. And they didn't, they certainly didn't deal with them in the same way. And they weren't allowed to discipline in the same way and those kinds of things. And so, yeah, it was just sort of a breakdown.
So how does your view juxtapose from your mother's?
So, my background is more of a corporate background. I did not do 35 years in education. I grew up in sort of corporate America from a professional standpoint. And so my frame is a little different, right? Mm-hmm. I look at it from the standpoint of, I actually truly believe that that integration was in many ways a merger of two cultures mm-hmm. and two entities, two groups of people that sort of came together. You had an African-American community that came together with a predominantly Caucasian community. Mm-hmm. And honestly, those two groups of people had strong, strong biases against each other. And we never really looked at it as we would with a merger in corporate America. We would spend lots and lots and lots of time trying to work with each other on how do we take the best of both cultures and recognize that in one place, i.e. the workplace, we were going to need to figure out how to work together, right? We were going to have to figure out how to get the best of both of those things to come together and benefit the end consumer, which was the children. And we just never did that. We never did that. We took, again, two groups of people, we slapped them together. We never did sort of cultural training or intervention or any of that. And I think that a lot of the ramification of that still exists today.
So, you know, it's an interesting, I think it makes a lot of sense to compare it to, you know, a corporate merger. But in your experience with corporate mergers, you know, that equanimity isn't, I think that's the exception rather than the norm. I think it takes exceptional leaders to make that happen. And usually it's just one company, usually the buyer, that sort of dictates, you know, money talks kind of thing.
That's right. So I've actually seen two types, right? I've absolutely seen that type. Most recently at Tech Data, though, we actually brought two companies together and I was only on the board. So I only watched this you know, provided some counsel and guidance, but I think they did a great job of bringing two cultures together mm-hmm. and ending up with a better whole, right? A better whole that was more beneficial, certainly for the customers who now have access to a much broader portfolio of services, but also for the employee base, which now has a much broader portfolio of growth opportunities across the whole. And so I do think that it can be done, and I think it can be done very, very well. There are some cultures that are incredibly good at it, some companies that are incredibly good at it, and you're right, for many others, they are not good at it, and it doesn't work.
I think in this instance, that kind of has to be done, right? I mean, it's the only right way forward. So you know, having this understanding and, you know, even having these benchmarks in the corporate world, how do you activate those strategies with youth education?
I think the first thing we did as we came in and we looked at it, we said, we're really truly focused on outcomes. It's not that we're only focused on outcomes, but we're truly focused on outcomes. Mm-hmm. So we really began to look at, and I think we're one of the first not-for-profits in the space to be able to say, are we generating an outcome or aren't we? Because the truth is that, honestly, if we're not helping children to close that achievement gap, then there's no purpose. We're not achieving our mission. So we really shone a spotlight on the fact that we could actually move children. We use a curriculum, a program from Curriculum Associates called iReady as our assessments. The school also uses iReady, and it was really important to us to use something that would be familiar to the Pinellas County school system and to educators, so we would have something to in common to talk about. And so using that set of metrics, we looked at assessing children pre the start of our 8-week camp and then post. And by looking at that data, we could actually say to them, look, there was no summer learning loss, and not have that sort of challenged, if you will, because it's data that they are familiar with. They're very similar, you know, they use very similar data. And not just that, but then to look really within specific domain areas and understand what did we move within the domains of reading or the domains of math to actually achieve that growth or achieve that, that lack of learning loss. How did that happen? Being able to talk specifically about that. So I think that's one thing that I bring to it from a business perspective. I think the other thing that I bring to it is really, or that we tried to bring to the model, was an understanding that, you know, you had to actually pay for and value the expertise of people coming in. So many of the programs that we would consider, you know, after school or out of school programs really don't have or don't employ a lot of teachers, and especially not in small groups, for example, during the summertime. It's an expensive resource in the context of that type of program. So we said, no, we believe in the value of teaching. And so we're going to pay teachers, qualified, certified teachers, to come in and actually teach the children and try to close some of the gaps during the summer months. And that has also worked. And then I'd say the final thing, which goes back to where we started in terms of my mom's sort of view and also that cultural view, is we truly believed that you needed educators in the room that come from the culture. Mm-hmm. And so we brought in assistants and often teachers who were very familiar from a cultural standpoint with how these children sort of move and navigate, as well as through the families. We also have a family liaison as a part of our program. And she in particular knows all of the, or many of the families that we serve. And so they know what challenges the families are dealing with. They can often help the families in dealing with those, you know, sort of extraneous challenges, food, housing, right, all kinds of medical costs, things of that sort, those wraparound services that the city is actually trying very hard to help provide. We can help them tap into some of those. But at the same time, you know, when a child is misbehaving, it's much easier for us to pull them aside and have a culturally relevant conversation about, so, you know, what is this about or what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like a small thing, but I have to say I went through a time in my own life when, you know, my mom and my family was actually dealing with the death of my father, and I was acting out as a middle schooler, and it was, you know, it was really challenging, and it was one African-American dean who pulled me aside at Bay Point Middle and said, okay, look, you know, what is happening here? We need to do this and that. We just had a very culturally relevant, very specific to my family situation, right, conversation that had me to take a step back and rethink it and acknowledge that I didn't want them to call my mom. She was dealing with a whole bunch of other stuff. Right. I really did want to try and minimize, you know, the fallout. any additional fallout. And so I, you know, I straightened up a bit, and I did get through middle school in a pretty good way. So
that's great. I love that you mentioned in that second item the value and the fee. You know, we've done nonprofit related programs, and you know, the immediate rush is to think about the good that you're doing, and we gave away a lot of our services for free. And time again, you know, the quickest way to destroy value is to tell people that immediately up front what you're giving them is free and doesn't have that value. And you know, once people got skin in the game, it just totally changed their perspective on it, their outlook, how they took it seriously. It gave them that, you know, the initial launch was that there was value in this. You know, in some extent, even the more you have to stretch for it to get there, the more you actually will value it, the more you'll take it seriously. I think that's something can be counterintuitive, that it's wonderful that you've recognized and added to the total prop. So with that, then I guess, you know, the first sort of elements that we were talking about of the degradation of the sort of, you know, educational climate was the, you know, the integration, the general devaluing of education. And that's a big problem to tackle. I don't think it's realistic to expect a small nonprofit to just go out and educate the world. So it sounds like I would say that you're trying to basically build influencers, build that bedrock of people from within the community who are growing up with that value, who are growing up with that educational success. And then that will then spread and proliferate into the rest of the community. Is that fair to say?
I think it is. I think to a certain extent that group of people exists, and you're right. We want to tap into them as influencers, but honestly, some of those people are not necessarily, they wouldn't necessarily be considered influencers on a day-to-day basis. Yeah. You have definitely people like Renee Flowers, who's out there always, you know, in the media. People recognize her as a huge supporter of children, from South County. And so she's definitely what I would consider an influencer. Yes, we absolutely want to be front and center with Renee. But more importantly, there are a cadre of family members, whether they be grandparents. A lot of our caregivers have been grandparents. And so we have a lot of grandparents out there, as well as there are, you know, parents even within the community that do recognize the value, and yet their children are suffering because often they're going side by side to school with children in an environment that's not conducive to learning. And so they do want to put their children in a place where, you know, that learning is valued. At the same time, by the way, you have every teacher in our group, for example, would say they love teaching. They love teaching, and yet I've seen them sit in the parking lot. I've seen one in particular sit in the parking lot for 15 minutes with classical music blowing just to reset herself, because she says, you know, the environment that she happens to be coming from is not so conducive to teaching, and the environment that she's coming into requires a different mindset. So, you know, you just really want to find those people, get them together, and let them do magic for children, right? And that's, I think, also a wonderful thing that our program has been able to accomplish.
I wasn't actually clear when I said influencers. I actually was talking about the children. I meant that they, having gone through this and brought this, you know, had this value of this education they're receiving because of what, you know, what they had to do to get in there and achieve that, that they would then influence their peers. They would then, as they went up through the educational system, would carry those values forward, and then that would sort of spread around to their, you know, siblings and to their friends and to other folks in the community.
Yeah, so I think that is absolutely a great point. Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And I think that these kids are going to change the community in a number of ways. I think they are absolutely going to be influencers within their peer group, mm-hmm. and certainly within their familial group, right? So they will absolutely do exactly as what you said. But I think this group of kids will also do other things as well. I think they're going to be, because of the curriculum, we focus, as I said, on reading and math, but we also give them STEAM training, a lot of STEM focus with some art to develop both sides of the brain. And with that in mind, these kids are going to be able to compete for jobs that prior generations were not. You know, we don't have a huge representation. If you look at the tech sector today, we don't have a huge representation of African Americans in that tech sector. We especially don't have African Americans from that community that are participating. You and I have talked about before the fact that, you know, you've got the Suncoast Guild right downtown that mm-hmm. offers, you know, really wonderful education in programming, computer programming. And the graduates of that program are getting wonderful job opportunities. But people from our community are not going. They're not attending those classes. They're not registering. And so with that in mind, I really think that these students are going to be much more comfortable, much more savvy. One of the stories I always like to tell people is about a first grader, and I'll just call him Jay. But he actually came in the first day. We were just talking about him today, actually. He came in the first day and he was, no, I'm not getting on the computer. We just, as I said, we like to do pre-tests. So we wanted to just test them, get their initial assessment score. No, I'm not good at computers. He says, I don't want to go on the computer. And he literally ran from the room crying. I don't want to do it. I don't want to touch the computer. I don't want to be on it. I'm not good at it. And so we had a conversation with him directly about how nobody's good when they first started something. You have to, you know, practice, it requires this and that. And, you know, a couple other people had conversations. The next day I said, look, I want you to try, even if it's just sitting there for 10 minutes and just being one with the computer. You know, you have to try, you have to do something. So I just watched him fast forward. We flipped to remote learning in mid-March. And I just watched him on the computer on a recorded session on Monday or Tuesday, actually. He was doing a STEAM lesson. And he was she's teaching the basics of coding, which is basically learning that you take a block of information and you move it from sort of one place to another place, and that causes something to happen, right? And so she was just trying to teach that basic concept. And I watched him on his computer with his mouse, moving things from here to here and using his reading skills to figure out where was the continue. And, and this is guy's first grade, you know, reading, just trying to figure out where's the continue and how do I move it from here to here. It's a program called Rover. And he did a fabulous job. And this is a kid who, again, in January would not go near a computer. So he's clearly going to be more digitally savvy, more ready to take those classes at Suncoast Guild or to, you know, go on and get, you know, some sort of degree that'll lead him to a wonderful education, whether it be engineering or other things. And as a result, wonderful job prospects, right? And that's the goal.
That's a great story. You mentioned online learning. Obviously, you've had to pivot since the pandemic has started. You know, within your programming, but I think more interestingly within the community, what are you seeing the effects of the pandemic, you know, in the students and the families that you serve?
Yeah. So I don't think it's any surprise, but nationally, all the data points to the fact that children living in disadvantaged communities are disproportionately impacted by the COVID-19 shift in terms of learning. Moving to remote learning. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One being the access to technology, whether it be laptops or Wi-Fi. The other being, you know, just in terms of the parental attention, right? The ability to actually have parents who are capable and have the time to really homeschool, to really sit and dedicate to the children. Many in our community don't have that. We definitely saw issues initially with access to laptops. The school, the Pinellas County School System, again, did a fantastic job, actually, of trying to make computers available to everyone. And so, you know, many of them were able to solve it through that. Even with that, we had children who couldn't get there or couldn't do this, parents who were working late in the night and couldn't therefore get to the school to get the computers, et cetera. So we put in place a loaner system where we were able to loan out laptops to children whose parents really couldn't get there. And we have, you know, 10 to 15. Now we only serve, remember, we serve 60 kids. So out of that pool of 60, 63, actually, we had a good 10 who we needed to loan laptops because for whatever reason, the parent couldn't get to the school to get one. In addition to that, you know, in addition to that, Wi-Fi access has been a challenge. Many of our parents have had issues with Spectrum, so they weren't able to take advantage of the Spectrum offer. We've had to really go out of our way to get Wi-Fi hotspots for them to leverage and to get on. And so we took perhaps a different approach. We, again, as I said, we really want to work with the school system. And our belief is that the child needed to be able to access that school system remote learning platform first and foremost. And what we also then found was that parents had no idea, despite, again, all the efforts of the school system to educate around how to do that. Many of our parents just had no clue. And they, again, remember, often we're dealing with grandparents as well. So they were terrified of it and they would walk away. So we decided that we would offer online training programs, Zoom sessions like the one you and I are having, so that we could really walk them through step by step. How do you get on? And even with that, I will tell you, every single day that we are on this remote platform, we get at least 2 calls for kids who can't get on. There's a grandparent, there's a kid who, you know, has moved from the grandparent to the aunt or to the aunt's house, and they don't remember their password, or they don't remember how to get on. And so, again, you have to walk them through. So we've maintained a hotline for students to call, so that if you are having trouble getting on for your classes, you call the hotline, myself or Mr. Jerwan or Mr. Elliott picks up, and we will show you how to get on so that you don't miss the class and the instruction. So it's been that kind of hands-on, high-touch, very adaptive sort of programming that we've had to put in place to serve the needs of this community. And again, even with that, we know that the gap is widening for these children relative to their peers in this environment.
I guess the good news is it'll be about a month away from Jay, the first grader, being able to jump on the tech support line and help people. So that'll be nice.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I have to say, I think he will be. He'll be really good at that. And what we have seen, though, is that, again, we put in this platform, and we decided to go with Microsoft Teams because that was what they were learning in school. And we wanted to, again, reinforce that school platform. What are you learning in school? How do you navigate that? Let's reinforce that. So we decided to use the same thing. And that has gone very well for us. The kids are coming, and you know, we have about 50%, to be honest, because again, many of the students, the parents are just too burdened to monitor it, and they can't do it. But about 50% of our students are showing up every day and getting onto the platform, and they're loving it. I mean, they're getting much more. Ours, we decided also to do live classes because in this period, what we're also finding is that many of the children are feeling a bit more isolated. And so when they get on with their teachers and they are able to see, even if it's 2 or 3 friends, they love it. They absolutely love it. And we are also seeing that they're able to interact with some learning programs like the Rover one that I mentioned earlier in ways that they hadn't been able to do before. And, you know, they're learning to, again, share their screen and navigate and really put up their work and get critiques and do critiques of one another's work, which I also find to be very fascinating. So, you know, in the past, we would not necessarily, particularly in a fourth grade class with 20 students or 25 or 30 students, you would never really want to subject a child to putting up his or her work on Blackboard and have it be critiqued by others. And here in this kind of small remote setting, the teachers have found that to be magical. You know, they'll put up their work and, you know, again, 2 or 3 peers will say, oh, I like this part. You have to also, though, they've been very structured about it, right? You have to say something you like. They like something, and then they give a point of feedback. So again, all skills that you need for future work.
It makes me really happy. You know, the things that you're talking about, that you've been able to pivot and do these things, you know, to go from regular classes to online learning, to live online learning, to adapting the curriculum. You know, that shouldn't be taken for granted. You've had a very substantial professional career. Your husband has been very successful in the medical field. And, you know, that we get this kind of concentrated brain power so focused on, you know, a modest group size group of kids. You know, that's one of those great experiments you like to see just how much, you know, because going back to that influencer, you know, thread we had earlier, the amount of advancement that you're going to give to these kids is going to be so important as they, you know, in turn give that to their community. And so it's really interesting. It's really interesting to, you know, when you get this sort of, it just doesn't happen when you get this much talent focused on this pinpoint of an effort.
I think it's great. And I will also say one of the things that you talk about is, you know what, throughout our careers, we've had different exposures, right? Mm-hmm. And so we've had to learn to pivot. Elliot, my husband Elliot is a cardiologist who became an IT specialist. Mm-hmm. And so he's had to learn as medicine became much more technology oriented. And by the way, his background is in engineering. And so he's had to, you know, really shift from a perspective of his work. And certainly that's the case in terms of my background. I started in marketing. I then became, you know, I went to general management. I started in food. I went to pharma. And I, by the way, my background from an educational standpoint is in computer policy and that kind of stuff. So it's a computer programming rather and economics. And so, you know, it's that kind of agility, learning agility that we want to share and have our children develop. And I think that that does represent something interesting in the not-for-profit space. As I've talked with many peers, it's been great because I've been able to say, don't be afraid of it. Just embrace it. There are going to be positive things that come out of it for our children. So let's figure out what those are and try to capitalize on them. But that is a different mindset. It is a very different mindset, I think, at any rate, than some of my peers might bring to it.
Wonderful. And you just launched a new website, sppf.org.
Yes.
Exciting.
Yeah, it is. It's very exciting.
And so what's the summer look like for you now with the restrictions on classrooms?
So it's interesting. We've actually decided that we want to do an integrated learning approach for the summer because we've had such positive response and such success with the online or remote learning piece. We don't want to lose it, right? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I actually did quite a bit of research as I was preparing our remote learning piece to talk to some of the most successful implementers in other schools, right? And one of the things that they had said to me is, oh yeah, no, we have maintained this integrative thing. So one school administrator that I talked to in another state actually said to me, no, we actually started this as a way to manage snow days. But what we found was we actually would do a half day, for example, every week in remote learning. So every week the kids know that there'll be at least a half day where they'll be at home and they'll be on their computer for a couple of hours and they're expected to be in class and all that kind of thing. And then what happens is when you have a snow day, it's second nature. Oh, we're moving to the online platform. Okay, we'll go do that. So it becomes a part of how they learn, right? It's just a part of their everyday experience. And that is what I think we should be trying to strive for all children. So that's the first piece. So for our kids, one of the things that we are looking to do for the summer, we are going to be obviously having to pivot again. We would normally have been growing to 100 students that we would be serving this summer. We're going to be serving half that, which is probably 50 students in our summer learning program on site. Now, even with that on-site programming where we have, you know, typically 4 hours of learning in the morning, and then we have different sort of arts programs that rotate through in the afternoon. So we have math lesson, literacy lesson, and then a STEAM or STEM lesson in the morning, as well as then what we call an intervention. So whatever your weakest subject is, you spend time with a small group working on that. So those are the 4 hours of learning we typically have in the morning. And then in the afternoon, we have things like there's swimming, there's a field trip on Friday, swimming on Wednesdays. And then there's a dance class or art class or, you know, something of that sort, or music, that kind of thing. So that's the way we normally would have run. What we're doing is we're doing two things. One, we are switching up at least one of the morning classes to be more reflective of this remote learning piece, right? So we're putting up a project, we're asking them to work on it. There'll be a live teacher interface, and then you'll be able to have a conversation around that. So we're going to move to one of those classes being an integrated learning class or an online learning class. So we think we're looking forward to seeing how that's going to work, because we're excited about that. And then in the afternoons, we're looking to even expand some of the sort of small group classes, right? Because you know, with fewer kids, the idea would be, okay, well, we'll just have fewer services. No, we now know with this online or remote learning piece, we can actually have more. So we're looking to sign on with some folks. Like, there is a wonderful arts program that's being offered locally, and we'll do that via remote learning. We'll let them have a remote, for example, a remote book club where they can all come together. They'll be in one group. There'll maybe be a group over here and a group over there in different parts of the country even that are talking about a book. So that can be a really cool thing too. So that'll be sort of a book club. Maybe we'll have, again, an art club that will go on. We'll still have a live dance club, and we'll have we're going to actually do some coding with the Suncoast Guild. So we'll have a coding club as well for middle schoolers. So that's sort of the on-site platform. And then what we're doing is we're also trying to ensure we still serve as many kids as possible. So we're looking at a potential collaboration and partnership with Boys and Girls Clubs of, I think it's Suncoast is what they're calling themselves, but it's Freddie Williams's organization. And we're looking at how can we use our remote learning platform to help with education within the context of his clubs. Because they right now, obviously, they have a desire to do that, but the big focus for them is really on a lot of the other programming. And so we're looking at how can we use our remote learning program to enhance what he's doing around education. So I'm really excited about it.
I'm going to call it now. We've just barely scratched the surface of what you're going to do with this online learning platform. It's going to be talking this time next year. You're going to like, oh, you know, we've got 4,000 kids on the platform, and you know. That's my prediction. So I'm marking it right now in history.
All right, there we go. Let's hope you're right.
I've enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for sharing all of that, and thank you for all the just truly invaluable work that you're doing and bringing innovation and you know, focusing on the places that don't get enough focus. That's really, you know, that's really special and very important. And thank you for doing that.
Thank you so much, Joe. I really appreciate it. I also enjoyed the conversation. You know, we have met several times and we've never had the opportunity to have this in-depth a conversation about it. So I really appreciate it.
Me too.